Hello, Catherine.
Hello, Nina.
Another podcast.
Action movies. Oh, I'm so excited. Yeah.
Yes, the occasion is a sad one because this is to commemorate the sad passing of one of the greatest actors that ever lived, who has a huge body of work and who is probably known to anybody who has a pulse on this planet.
Yeah.
And I'm talking about the very recent passing of Sir Sean Connery, whom probably everybody knows who has ever watched a movie, or even those who haven't. So we have decided that, being extremely tired for various reasons, mentally, physically, and in any possible way, that we're going to have a light entertainment podcast today. No heavy issues of survival or crises. And the way we're going to structure it, that first we're going to talk about your favorite movies and my favorite movies, as we often do. And at the end, we're going to leave the candy for the end, the dessert. The dessert will be talking about the Bond movies.
Okay.
So I will be very grateful if, whenever we talk about movies, if you see some implications for talking about either the economy, finance, or political implications of movies that he appeared in, then it would kind of enliven our discussion of the entertainment content.
Okay.
And I have noticed that in the movie lists that Solari has, there is very often either a Bond movie, very often a Bond movie, or sometimes just a Sean Connery movie.
Yeah.
When you're talking about some completely different subjects, like either deep state, or that you're talking about the politics or economic implications. So I would be very grateful if you had some other remarks there.
Yeah, there's a lot of deep state communication, certainly in the Bond movies, and in many of the other movies as well. So he was not only a tall, handsome Scotsman, but he had had a successful career in the Royal Navy. So, you know, he was one of theirs.
Right. And he has a huge body of work, if you look at, you know, decade after decade, yeah, of wonderful movies that he has appeared in. So without...
And can I just say one other thing? The Bond series was written by Fleming, who, and if you look at the Fleming family, it's a very prominent Scottish family. So, you know, whether the Royal Navy line or the Scottish line, you know, matching up with the Flemings, who were very huge in the world of investment and intelligence.
Not to mention the small DK that Ian Fleming himself actually worked for OSS, but...
Right.
that's not here nor there, right?
Right. So he was really... matched perfectly with the whole, not just the movies, but the books and the tradition and the, you know, the truth of what was really going on. So there's no doubt the Bond movies communicated a lot of messages to the general population from the deep state. Anyway, so more when we get into Bond. You go.
Right. Well, what is your first non-Bond Sean Connery movie that you would like to talk about?
So my absolute favorite Sean Connery movie is not one of the Bond movies. You know, I love action movies, but I love very complex, high intelligence stories. And my favorite movie with Sean Connery is The Name of the Rose, where Sean Connery plays, you know, it's a murder mystery set in the medieval times. And Connery is a friar, Franciscan friar, who is a bit iconoclastic, and he's sent to solve this murder mystery. And of course, the monastery is all ready to go into a snit about demonic and spiritual forces, whereas Connery knows it's probably a lot more grounded and practical. And the moral of the story, in fact, I just did it this week on Money and Markets. The moral of the story, of course, is when you try and hoard and keep secret a lot of valuable knowledge, you end up having enormous competition. And that's what happened. What happened was you had a group of monks going into the secret library and reading Aristotle, and another monk who didn't want them to be doing that. And you have a real competition over the sort of secret knowledge. Anyway, in the middle of it, who gets drug in but the Spanish Inquisition? And you get a little picture of how scary they really were and what a scary time that could be. But Connery, William of something is Connery's character. And he just shows the power of intelligence to handle all sorts of situations, whether mysteries or high politics that threaten your life. And of course, it comes out with a happy ending. So he solves the mystery. He beats off the Spanish Inquisition. And throughout, it's a very insightful picture into that time in the world, but also the issues of sort of secrecy and the power of knowledge. But his acting is fantastic.
Well, he's also...
And it's an old film.
This is a 1986 movie, so it's kind of
right
mid to late of his career. But he's obviously playing kind of against his type, because it's very kind of genius casting to cast James Bond as a monk, so to speak.
Well, the interesting thing is he's unbelievably sexy.
Well, that's why they...
He just exudes sort of...
That's what's the idea.
Right, but he exudes this incredible life force. I don't mean sexy in the, you know, the Goldfinger kind of way, but he just exudes this sort of magnetic, you know, sort of alpha male charisma throughout the movie. And, you know, you get the feeling it's one of the reasons the Spanish Inquisition guys are after him, because they're jealous.
Well, you can always count on Spanish Inquisition to kind of stir things up in any movie.
Right.
If in doubt, send for Spanish Inquisition. But the interesting thing is also that The Name of the Rose is written by Umberto Eco, who, at least in Europe, is very famous as a philosopher and writer of quite serious books on anthropology and history of culture. And that was his kind of exercise in writing a mystery novel. And he came up with something absolutely fantastic in terms of a puzzle that he sets in a medieval monastery. That's not something that normally has been done. And then they cast Sean Connery in it.
Well, what's interesting is Eco was the one who wrote the best book on who was Mr. Global.
Huh.
Yeah.
Tell me more.
Foucault's Pendulum.
Oh, yes. Okay.
It's the ultimate book on, you know, sort of how the planets really run.
Well, but that's true of Umberto Eco. You know, he was someone who was a philosopher. He wrote great books on kind of history of art and anthropology.
Uh-huh.
You know, he's one of those huge European 20th century thinkers.
Right.
And that was kind of like a trifle that he decided to write. It's not a trifle, it's a very thick book.
Right.
But all I'm saying is that it's something against the type of stuff that he would write. And then obviously once they turned it into a movie, it became even a more delicious piece of entertainment.
Right. So it was also, you know, so he was in Milan. It was a great way to take a dig at the Vatican and what they're doing with the Vatican Library in a way that was safe.
Exactly.
Right.
So I want to talk maybe from about the same period, a movie called The Russia House, which was delightful. A spy story plus romance. That's the Sean Connery and Michelle Pfeiffer, both of them at the height of their chemistry and seductive power, cast in a novel, I mean, in an adaptation of a spy novel that has Sean Connery as a kind of has-been alcoholic writer who is assigned by MI6 to go to Russia to retrieve documents from an informer, if you like, or a woman who contacted them, who is Michelle Pfeiffer's character. And he's not a spy. He's simply the person who happens to have a visa to Russia during the Cold War. So someone who can actually go there and pretend to be just going for a press junket for a literary conference, if you like. And obviously what happens is that he connects with her. They fall in love. He's trying desperately to get her out. The very menacing KGB in the form of Klaus Maria Brandauer, who is a German actor and who is excellent at playing the villains, is kind of pursuing them. This movie is actually made in 1990, which means that it has been shot, at least part of it, it was shot in Moscow because this is actually shot after the Cold War, but at the same time talks about the Cold War, and it was a very attractive movie at the time because it was kind of a glimpse into the world that we knew but couldn't see it on screen that much. And they are brilliant together in showing how, obviously in a very kind of entertaining and cinematic way, but how difficult it would be for a Westerner to come into contact with someone living behind the Iron Curtain, because first of all, nobody trusted anybody, meaning she would not know whether he's out to get her and it's a setup, and he doesn't know if the KGB is not going to spring a trap on him. So that was a very, very, very typical thing. If you lived somewhere in Eastern European countries, including Russia, you never knew if the person you're talking to is your best friend or best agent provocateur.
Yeah, or a trap.
And an informer.
Right.
It literally, you never knew, and half of the time you were right if you were suspicious. So that is beautifully rendered. We have great shots of the, you know, Red Square and the GUM, which was the only department store that was at the time in Moscow. I remember that store from like 1970s, and it was the, you know, seventh wonder of the world, considering everything else that was around it. It's in the middle, or it was in the middle of the Red Square. And again, you know, he's exuding this, playing brilliantly, an alcoholic, worn out, you know, British journalist who has no skills of a spy, but managed, you know, uses just his wits and daring to outwit everybody, including the KGB. It's 2 hours of entertainment, that's all I can say.
So, you know, I hate to say this, but I do think movies like this are great educational experiences for people in the West who are now dealing with similar kind of snitch problems.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in other words, you're living in a very paranoid environment with multiple agendas. And I think watching these kinds of movies helps people understand the kind of circumstance they're dealing with now.
Totally agree.
Yeah.
And this is a great movie too. I mean, this shows a very concrete situation of the East versus West, but you can easily transponder it to Asia, or, you know, transplant it to Latin America, or these days even here.
Right.
So what is your next movie?
So the next one, I love this movie and I love the book. It's The Hunt for Red October.
Mm-hmm.
Clancy published this book in 1984. I don't remember why, but I got it almost immediately. And I was out in the East Hamptons with my husband, who wanted to go to bed early, and I just couldn't put it down. So I sat in the bathroom all night and stayed up really late to read it. I just couldn't put it down. It was fantastic. So when the movie came out, you know, I just couldn't wait to see it. And it's absolutely, you know, it's just a thriller. If you love action movies, and that's my favorite genre, if you love action movies, this one is for you. And of course, I don't know what it is about Connery, who would play the consummate Brit in the Bond movies, suddenly turns Russian. So he's the commander of the Russian submarine. And, you know,
I think he was single-handedly responsible for recruitment to Russian Navy afterwards.
Anyway, so he's a Russian, and it's just one of those great thrillers. And I think the acting, did he ever win an Academy Award for this one?
I don't know if he won, but he was certainly nominated. And I remember when this came out and people were walking in the street and they were just saying, one ping and one ping only. I don't remember if you remember that.
It won an Academy Award for Best Film Editing, Best Sound, and Best Sound Effects.
Mm-hmm.
He got Best Actor at the British Academy Film Awards for this one.
Right.
No, now I take it back. It was nominated. So it only won Best Sound Effects Editing, and then it was nominated for Best Sound, Best Film at the Academy Awards, and then he got nominated for Best Actor. It's kind of, you know, you kind of wonder why, because it was such a remarkable...
It was a huge commercial success. In the 90s, more than in the 21st century, in the 1990s, usually the rule was that if the film was a commercial success, it would not be a critical success, meaning it wouldn't get, I mean, that may not even many nominations for the Academy Awards or, you know, all the...
Well, believe it or not, what they were up against for best, so they weren't even nominated for Best Picture, but that year you were up against Dancing with Wolves, Awakenings, Ghosts, The Godfather Part 3, and Goodfellas.
Well, that's one thing, but I can just tell you that if the movie was just extremely successful commercially, it would not be a candidate for Academy Awards. I remember this period very well because I...
Now, why was that?
...worked like a dog on all these campaigns. Well, because the assumption was that if the film is, which is purely entertainment commercial, this is not the type of movies that the Academy would vote for. They would vote for films that either were heavy kind of dramas, ideally with some illness attached, or, you know, terminal illness was always good, or some major, you know, war or a drama that was good, you know. If it had a happy end and it was commercially very, very successful, then this is not an Academy movie. That was almost, you know, maybe with the Black Panther, it changed slightly that they started looking at movies that were more commercially successful.
You know, I always have to remind everyone that Shakespeare and Dickens were both very successful commercially.
Yeah, but that is not how the Academy works. I mean, I remember the year when Avatar basically swept the planet and billions of people were watching Avatar, but it was deemed too commercial. And they gave the Best Picture Award to James Cameron's ex-wife, Catherine Bigelow, for Hurt Locker, which was a very engaged drama about Afghanistan, but no one watched that, of course. Everybody watched Avatar and everyone watched that.
Right.
That's a typical Academy scenario.
Right.
So I wouldn't even look at Oscar nominations. These are two different things. Sean Connery is famous for being a wonderful actor in great entertainment, not necessarily for, you know, movies that went all the way to the Oscar consideration. So Hunt for Red October, give me one ping and one ping only. That's what we always say. This is the best scene from the movie. And I will move to 1993 Rising Sun, where Sean Connery is playing a wizened, smart, how could I say? Well, he's a mover and shaker in investigation that involves a Japanese businessman living in Los Angeles. His partner in discovering the mystery is played by Wesley Snipes, who plays a kind of a rookie policeman, a rookie cop, a detective, and who is paired with Sean Connery, who plays golf with all those Japanese movers and shakers. And there is a murder case that they have to solve together. This is, being 1993, filmed at the height of Japan's domination in the world markets, thanks to the previous 20 years of doing very well in production of cars and other electronic goods. And there was a huge Japanese community at the time in Los Angeles. I remember going to Japan like a yo-yo back and forth because it was one of the most important markets. And there was this kind of unease amongst Americans who felt threatened that there is going to be a Japanese domination of business and economic power. No one was paying attention to China, but that's another story.
Right.
But the prevalent mood at the time, at least if you lived in a place like Los Angeles, where Japanese presence was kind of very evident in how much of the real estate they were purchasing, how many of them were living, the constant kind of business relationship, you know, Japan is the first port of call, if you like, if you do anything together with Japan. And I remember the planes were just literally packed. You couldn't get a seat on going to Tokyo because, you know, there was so much activity going back and forth. So from based on this stemming from that unease of Japanese-American relationship, that movie kind of renders this atmosphere of grudging respect and unease at the same time, which kind of is an undercurrent of the very good mystery where everything points to very sinister things, and then it turns out that things are much less sinister, much more mundane, if you like. And Sean Connery plays this fantastic character of the guy who knows everything about Japan, speaks Japanese, and knows how to maneuver and outmaneuver all the attempts to kind of shut down the investigation.
So he's very Bond because he's so suave in his ability to navigate.
Absolutely. Yeah. He's extremely Bond in this movie.
Yeah.
And since he wasn't doing Bonds by then, of course, because the last one he did was 1983, so 10 years before, this is like this movie was having a Bond experience without having Bond.
Right, exactly. This is Bond Does LA.
Exactly. Which he does in one of the Bond movies, but we'll talk about it later. So that was my next Bond movie. What is yours? Not Bond, but Sean Connery movie. And what is yours on your list?
So my next one is The Untouchables.
Okay.
So there's no doubt, and we'll talk about it when we get to Bond, that organized crime is a theme in a lot of movies and certainly Connery movies. But Untouchables is the story. It's a fictionalized version of Elliot Ness and the FBI when it's first created, trying to get, well, in fact, Ness was Bureau of Prohibition, trying to nail Al Capone in Chicago during Prohibition in the 30s. And so part of Ness's success depends on finding an Irish-American officer named Jim Malone, played by Sean Connery. And what was interesting is Connery often just maintained his Scottish accent no matter what he was doing and where he was. But, you know, here he had to be Irish. And it's not something you think of him as doing. And yet he was absolutely remarkable in this role. And he won the Academy Award. It was the only Academy Award this movie won. He for Best Supporting Actor, because he wasn't even the lead. It was Costner.
It was Kevin Costner.
Yeah, it was Kevin Costner playing Ness. But Connery was just absolutely superb. And it shows you how a supporting actor can really sort of steal the show, even when you have an all-star cast. So, you know, because you had...
Well, speaking to the Academy Awards, this is a perfect example. What happens is sometimes, you know, the Academy refrains of giving Oscars to someone for decades for various strange reasons. And then everybody realizes, oh my God, this person is getting old. And if we don't give him an Oscar, he will never get an Oscar because now he's not playing the main roles or whatever.
Right.
It is not only for the actors, because a perfect example is a lifetime Oscar to Ennio Morricone, who is the best film composer on the planet, you know, the one who did this music, for example, for The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and all the other Sergio Leone westerns. And dozens and dozens of the most famous movies on the planet were scored by Ennio Morricone, the Italian composer. And then at some point, the Academy realized, with some prodding from some very prominent filmmakers in Hollywood, that he really needs to be given an Oscar before it's too late. So they have done that, and it has given him a lifetime Oscar, which by that time he was literally, you know, in a wheelchair and hasn't lived much longer afterwards. They have done the same with Andrzej Wajda, who is probably the greatest Polish film director ever. They gave him an Oscar again, which was about 20 years delayed. They have done it with many, many actors and filmmakers and people from various film crafts. The Academy sometimes, you know, does that just because they realize, oh my God, if we don't do it now, when?
Right.
So I'm not saying that Sean Connery did not deserve it, but this was the year that 1987, everybody's saying, oh my God, he hasn't had an Oscar he should have had for about 20 right. movies before.
Right.
And he was brilliant in it. So they said, now or never, so to speak.
Right. And the acting, I mean, you had Robert De Niro, you had Andy Garcia, you had Kevin Costner. So this was really, they really pulled together an all-star cast for this one.
Exactly.
It was, the acting was amazing.
And it is an interesting, I mean, if you can talk about Prohibition for a second from your point of view, that would be great, you know, because it is a historical subject, but it says a lot of things about the world today, maybe.
Well, it's funny because if you look at the, you know, a lot of Americans, America, from the time you created the Federal Reserve, a lot of the sort of financial capital juggernaut in America has been built with organized crime. And of course, you can't get those margins on liquor unless you make it illegal. And a lot of great fortunes were built, including, you know, the word is the original Kennedy fortune was that and short selling. So, you know, so a lot of great fortunes were built in that time. But obviously, it gives you a situation where the feds have many different incentives to control the business and to channel the business. Obviously, the central banks control because they don't have to transact. You know, he who transacts the money ultimately controls. So, but this was a perfect example of watching the feds move in and try and organize the business. And of course, we know the Chicago machine was always for many, many years and still is a highly creative and interesting and expensive machine. And Capone was right at the heart of building that. So,
well, I'm looking at it from the other side. I mean, I don't disagree with you, but I'm just saying that on the other hand, I am just looking at people voting with their feet, so to speak. Meaning that there is a documentary about which I have written for Solari at some point called Prohibition, where basically the tagline is something like, you know, that the Americans took the freedom back or something like this, meaning the government was trying to prohibit buying and drinking of alcohol, and people just basically ignore that because right. there are some things that, you know, how are you going to prohibit that? You can either, you can criminalize it, but it's not going right. to change, you
right.
know.
It's not, you're not going to stop.
You know, the entire nation became basically criminals, right?
Right.
You know, it's just moved underground, but people did not stop drinking. You know? It's just like not very realistic. But I just find it very interesting, the whole prohibition social experiment, if you like.
Right.
So my last non-Bond movie is called The Rock, 1996. The premise is that there is a band of baddies, if you like. I think Anne Harris is the leader of them, who for various reasons hijack a shipment of highly toxic chemicals, which are in those green balls. And they take hostage a group of tourists at the Alcatraz that they are visiting. And then the villains are making demands on the authorities that if the demands are not met, then they are going to release the toxic gas over San Francisco. So this is the premise. And Sean Connery plays basically James Bond, who has been arrested many years ago, and he's being held in a high-security prison. He looks like something from medieval times, unkempt, very, very long white hair, held in some oubliette, never to be released. So, you know, he was a British spy who basically, James Bond, if you like, who has been arrested and has been held in American prison for decades. But he knows the Alcatraz, therefore they come to him and they said, we need your help. To which he says, what? The Alcatraz is now a tourist attraction? And obviously he knows nothing about the contemporary world because he literally, this is taking place in 1990s and he was arrested sometime in 1970s or 60s, you know, whenever the James Bond was active. Uh-huh. So he has kind of missed a couple of decades of anything in the world. So they come to him and they say that if he helps them, then they're going to, they offer him things that they never intend to keep, of course. They give him as a sidekick, Nicolas Cage, at the kind of beginning of his most prominent part of his career. Nick Cage plays a young chemist who is supposed to assist in neutralizing those green balls of toxic chemicals. And the two of them have to basically infiltrate the Alcatraz through the underground tunnels and overcome the villains. So Sean Connery, as this ex-Bond, is transformed from the long-haired Green Knight kind of person into a very suave, well-groomed James Bond type. And then when they come in, he mm-hmm. says, "Gentlemen, welcome to the Rock."
Wow.
So that's the premise. It's lots of fun entertainment. The whole idea is Sean Connery kind of doing a jazz-style riff on his old roles as James Bond, and he does it extremely well with huge grace, and it's a great 2 hours of entertainment. That's all I can say.
Who directed it? So Michael Bay.
Michael Bay, yes.
Who's Michael Bay?
It was not an easy movie to work on, I must say.
Right. Oh, I'm sure. So did you work on this one?
Oh, yeah. For about 2 years, yes. We did the premiere on the Alcatraz with, hundreds of press from...
Oh, you're kidding.
Yes. We had hundreds of press from all over the world. We had all the actors.
Oh, my word.
The day there was a press day, which was in San Francisco... We got a heat wave. You know, San Francisco doesn't get a heat wave. We suddenly got, almost, 95 degrees when San Francisco gets to 75 degrees at best in any given year.
Wow.
So we were working in a hotel without air conditioning in a heat wave.
How in the world did you get everybody out to Alcatraz?
Boats.
Boats, many boats. Many boats.
Yes, yes. It was an interesting experience.
But the movie was a great success.
The movie was a great success. Everybody was terrified of Sean Connery,
Why?
Because he was, he was James Bond, a huge star. He was, he didn't suffer fools gladly, and things had to be perfect to get a grant of approval, and it was not easy. You know, it's just like working with Queen of England, you're terrified all the time.
Right, right. It's funny because whenever a celebrity dies, because I'm registered investment advisor, I get lots of emails. All the different investment advisory websites and media focus on what were the tax, what was the estate planning and tax issues related to that celebrity. So I've just been reading about the extraordinary taxes Connery had to pay. He finally had to move to the Bahamas. Just for financial security, because he was paying such huge taxes in the UK. It was interesting.
Yeah, during Margaret Thatcher, so we're talking 1970s, maybe early 80s or something, the English tax laws were so stringent, if you like, that
right.
The majority of rich people has kind of moved to offshore havens because an incredible amount of their income was being taxed. So it wasn't Sean Connery, who was very Scott and extremely... financially mindful. he was a Scot.
Right.
What can I tell you?
He was a Scot. Well, the other thing is he was playing a character for the Fleming family.
Right.
So you're talking about big Scottish money here.
Right. But all I'm just saying is that he wasn't the only one,
Right.
All the writers or the filmmakers, actors, so whatever, and obviously all the businessmen have
right.
during Margaret Thatcher had to kind of go offshore to preserve whatever they were making. So, no surprises there.
Right.
And, besides he was not English, he was Scottish. So it's like, he already had probably...
So at that time, if you had Connery, because if you look at the poster, he's clearly the lead star. So in something like The Rock, if you have Connery, what are the odds? How do the odds for success increase when you have that kind of brand?
What are the odds that what, sorry?
That the movie is financially successful.
If you want a safe investment, never, ever, ever invest in entertainment, okay? Because, That's the rule number one.
Right.
You know, unlike any other industry on the planet that I know, the film industry is a total casino, meaning a total gambling risk. You can invest $200 million on Thursday, and on Friday morning when the film comes out, you have just lost $200 million and some.
Right.
There is no rule or rhyme or reason to it, because every single product that the film industry produces is different from the previous one and the next one.
Right.
It is not detergent. Every movie is completely different and has completely different life from any other. So there are obviously certain patterns and franchises and ways to diminish the risk and spread the risk and calculate it. And much of the film industry is devoted to that. But at the end of the day, you can be a millionaire on a Thursday, and on a Friday morning, you're a pauper. So I'm only half joking when I'm saying do not invest in the entertainment industry, at least not in movies as such. Which does not stop people and companies from investing, because obviously the attraction of being associated with something like The Rock is huge.
Right.
Obviously, if the gamble pulls off, if the movie is successful, then you can invest $2 million, like even much less, a few hundred thousand, like in a Blair Witch Project, for example, and then reap millions and millions upon millions on a gift that keeps on giving in, you know, in streaming and television rights and so on.
Hans Zimmer did the music for The Rock. I love his music. He's always doing movies I love.
He's kind of a to-go guy for major action films, has been for several companies, including the one that produced The Rock.
Right.
All right, so I think we really need to move on to Bond, because it's all very nice, and this is was the kind of like Sean Connery's second and extremely successful career post-Bond.
Bond.
But the reason everybody on the planet knows him is James Bond. Before I go to chronology, which I want to kind of list here, I just wanted to tell you that I don't know if the world would even know, but during the Cold War, James Bond movies were banned in Eastern Europe, and you could go to jail for bringing in anything related to James Bond. Literally. Two things were banned, pornography and James Bond.
Wow.
You tell me why.
Wow. So if you brought in a Bond movie poster, you could go to prison for that?
Yes.
Wow.
And of course, it would get confiscated. So, you know, if you were border police, you probably had a wonderful collection of James Bond stuff. But you could get arrested for a Playboy, you know, bringing in a Playboy, much less a James Bond.
Right.
But James Bond was banned, which obviously created a huge hunger for seeing them all, if you managed to get out.
Uh-huh.
But let me just do the quick housekeeping chronology. So the first Bond that he did was called Dr. No, 1965. The second, and the one that he considered his most favorite one, was called From Russia with Love, 1963. Then there was Goldfinger, 1964. Thunderball, 1965. You Only Live Twice, 1967. Diamonds Are Forever, 1971. And Never Say Never Again, 1983. Which was actually produced not by the Broccolis, I think, but was kind of like a competing story. I don't remember exactly, but I think that was his return, of course, about 10 years later. But it was kind of, there were two competing Bonds that came out at the same time. One was with Sean Connery.
What was it? I don't think I've seen, and I thought I'd seen them all. Never Say...
Never Again.
Never Again.
1983. So your pick of one Bond that you would like to talk about.
Goldfinger.
Okay.
So, you know, what I would really like to talk about with the Bond movies is they, and Goldfinger really signifies this, it's always, the brilliance of the Bond movies is they took, So if you read certain people who cover organized crime and global tax havens and money laundering, what they will tell you is that they always swear is the Brits and the City of London and MI5 and MI6 run global narcotics trafficking and organized crime, and the British tax havens run essentially the biggest pie of the money laundering. But the genius of the Bond branding was it made it look like the Brits were the ones who were standing for the rule of law and stopping all of this. So Bond, and I think this is one of the reasons that Connery was knighted, the Bond movies did an absolutely sensational job of protecting the British multiple personality disorder. On one hand, your power comes from the fact that you're basically controlling global money laundering and sort of whole central banking warfare model. On the other hand, James Bond has convinced everybody in the world that MI5 and MI6 are the ones who are stopping all the bad guys and are standing between us and the abyss because they are the rule of law. And if you look at the branding, it's absolutely brilliant. I mean, it's just unbelievably brilliant. And the other thing is, if you look, and there's a core of truth in this, if you look at the British intelligence services, they are masters of using intelligence, whereas the Americans are masters of using force. And so...
Well, you use what you have.
Right. Bond is in the tradition of using savoir-faire and intelligence in very clever ways. And so he's very much in the British tradition of intelligence, you know, which is the more sophisticated, more successful. You know, the inheritance of that tradition is actually Bill Nighy and the Worker trilogy, which you've written about. Then the last thing I want to talk about Bond is, or the second to last thing, is the Bond movies really explain how much action is in space. And while the Bond movies are explaining to everybody space, 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 for some reason, the corporate media was able to persuade everybody that after Kennedy died, space was over and nothing was going on in space. But the Bond movies were actually telling you, no, there's, you know, world rule is being engineered from space. And, you know, because James is out there flying around, you know, you really see that. The reason I would choose Goldfinger is, you know, at the very heart of this central banking warfare model is gold.
Mm.
And that idea was never promoted by the corporate media, but sure, again, the message is there from the deep state. You know, gold's at the heart of the thing. So there was a lot of great truths in the Bond movies that were not available in the corporate media. So there was basically tremendous secrecy around space, tremendous secrecy around gold, you know, every effort not to bring it up. But over here, you know, the Bond movies were kind of like a, you know, a secrecy-free zone where you could tell the truth, but it was so, you know, it was so glamorized, nobody connected it back to how the world really works.
Ah, that's fascinating. They're kind of like a...
Yeah.
A safety valve some truth escapes, but it escapes in the form of escapist entertainment, right? Glamorous entertainment.
Right. And the thing they keep warning you is the world is not run by governments. The world is run by organized crime, which is a meta cartel above the governments. And it's all very explained out. If you go back, I did this a couple years ago. I went back, bought all the Bond movies and watched them all to see what it said about space. And I thought, good Lord, you know, they really, it's amazing what they've documented in the Bond movies, if you just take it seriously for one second.
Right. I have to rewatch them this way. This is fascinating.
Well, I think if you said, you know, that these were outlawed behind the Iron Curtain, I think it was because it did such a good job of inversion and making the Brits look like the good guys that it must have driven, I would think it would have driven the Russians crazy.
No, you're giving them too much credit. The reason the Bond movies were banned is because the villains in those movies are the Russians. And of course, nobody can vilify the Russians if you live in Czechoslovakia, Poland, Bulgaria, and so on, you know.
Yeah, the Russians have never had a good sense of humor.
No, exactly. So, no, this is much simpler. You know, you're giving them way too much credit.
Well, you know...
But I also want to say that these Bond movies were based on Ian Fleming novels that were obviously written earlier, and the earlier period, you know, 1940s, 1950s, whatever, 40s and the whole 50s decade, is the period where British Empire was losing one colony after the other and kind of diminishing in political and military power. So these kind of books that put the British back on the map as the masters of intelligence, for example, were kind of a way of getting the society, like a psychotherapy for the society, if you like. Yes, we're losing the power, but not exactly if you wrote the book.
Well, in a funny kind of way, it was putting them back in the game.
Exactly. Which is what the Americans have repeated during the Vietnam War. And then that's why you had the Rocky and Rambo series. Well, especially Rambo series and the Deltas Force series in the 1980s were, they were actually losing wars like Vietnam War, but on screen, wherever the Marines hit the beaches, they were successful.
Right. Exactly.
Which actually was not a bad thing, you know, the kind of mass psychotherapy for the society. It's an interesting anthropological phenomenon that I think should be more studied. But there is definitely something like this to the Bond movies. But they would not be as good as they were if not for Sean Connery, which we know from the subsequent James Bonds, you know, George Lazenby and Timothy Dalton, and you know what I mean.
Well, you know, here's the thing that has plagued the Bond movies is that from the time Connery stepped down forward, so from Diamonds Are Forever forward, you know, the rap on all these guys, they're not Connery. You know, they're good. You know, Roger Moore's good, but he's not Connery. Or Dalton's, he's okay, but he's not Connery. Or Pierce Brosnan, he's not Connery. You know, Daniel Craig... It's like they're all having to beat the ghost of Sean Connery. It's incredible. Yeah.
Totally. They all have to live to the high standard. You know, the Roger Moore period, handsome as he was and a lovely man that he was. The problem is that obviously that was the kind of comedic take on it. You know, this was all lightweight. You know, he didn't have the gravitas and it was a period of James Bond's movies to be kind of basically comedies. I think a little bit of clenched jaw attitude was brought back by Pierce Brosnan, who did a very good job. And then Daniel Craig is a kind of modern Bond that is steely-eyed and clenched jawed, you know, kind of assassin. But you're absolutely right. Sean Connery set up the standard that every other subsequent actor has to match and be measured against. And I have just realized that you and I have managed to, as I say, waste a perfectly good hour of our listeners' time. We're out of time. We can say...
So I want you to write a column about Connery and the, you know, I'd love for you, because there's so many great eye candy pictures of Connery in these different movies. It's
okay, maybe. I mean, if the day had 48 hours instead of 24, that would be even better. But we'll put it on a list. So I think we both are huge fans of Sean Connery in almost every movie. And we hope that the listeners will have exactly the same pleasure experiencing those movies, which are probably known to most of the people by now, but sometimes the movies are worth rewatching, right?
Absolutely. It's funny, and one of the things I've decided to do is rewatch several of these. And now that I know you worked on it, I'm going to rewatch The Rock.
It's fun.
It is fun. It was a really fun movie.
It wasn't fun when I was working on it, but it was fun. Yes, I do love that one.
It was a really fun movie. Well, thank you, Nina Hein. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Catherine. Until the next one.
Bye.
Bye.